Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The street protests in Sudan over economic conditions prompted a violent crackdown. The government conceded that close to 100 people were killed, but activists said the actual death toll was twice as high. The protests compelled outside observers to compare and contrast them with the Arab Spring uprisings in Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt. On today's show, we'll speak with a freelance journalist based in Khartoum. In the second half of the show, we'll hear from a scholar who studies the region and another journalist who's reported from Sudan. But first, World Watch with Raymond Tungekar.
The trial of ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi began this week in Cairo. A defiant Morsi entered the courtroom wearing a suit instead of the white garments typically worn by defendants. Morsi questioned the legitimacy of the trial, saying that he was still the country's leader. At one point, Morsi's 14 co-defendants, all senior members of the Muslim Brotherhood, chanted, "Down with military rule." The chaos forced the presiding judge to adjourn the trial for over an hour. Morsi's trial was later postponed until January 8th to give defense lawyers time to review crucial documents. After 20 months of fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the rebel group known as the M23 has finally backed down. Their leader announced the group was ready to disband and negotiate with the Congolese government to end the violent conflict. The announcement came shortly after government forces routed M23 fighters out of several rebel strongholds. The event marks a drastic turning point for the nation, renewing hope for peace in a region that's been marred by almost 20 years of insurgency, extreme hunger, and disease. The Brazilian government admitted this week that it spied on diplomats from several countries, including the U.S., Russia, and Iran. According to the newspaper Folha de São Paulo, Brazilian intelligence agents followed diplomats on foot and by car in Russia and Iran, and also monitored the U.S. embassy in Brasilia. The revelations have forced Brazilian officials to defend themselves, even as they remain critical of the U.S. for its own spying program. Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff canceled a state visit to Washington in October over reports the NSA monitored her phone and email. And that's it for World Watch.
Joining me now is Salma Ismail. She's a Sudanese-American journalist. She was an editor with the Yemen Times before she moved to Khartoum 3 years ago to work with an international humanitarian organization. She's now back to writing full-time. Salma, welcome to Global Journalist.
Hi, thank you.
Salma, you wrote about the recent protests in Sudan for Open Democracy's website. Tell us what happened.
Well, protests in Sudan have been ongoing on and off for the third year now. This is not the first time. But this is the first time that the government responded with such a lethal force. Mm-hmm. It is also the first time that protests were this violent. Protesters were really escalating. So there was a real escalation from both sides. It was lethal. Whatever the number of people killed, 100 or 200, mm-hmm. it's a very high number. Right now, in terms of protests and demonstrations, the government has succeeded with its efforts to keep large numbers of protesters off the streets, but for now only.
Okay. Were you able to witness some of the conflict?
I did witness some of it. I can say that the government response, plus the lack of organization, has caused the protests to die down. There is right now an air of cautious, though very hopeful, calm, underlined by a very strong sense of anger and resentment. And many people are expecting that this will explode with the bursting of the economy, which is going downhill. Protesters were started out calling for better services, mm-hmm. Improving the standard of living. People were protesting at hospitals against electricity cuts. For such a resource-rich country like Sudan, mm-hmm. it's a shame that our inflation rate stands close to 45%. Rarely protesters were calling for regime change, but now they are. But then on the other hand, people in Sudan are looking at what is happening in countries like Libya and Tunis and Egypt. And they look at the large number of Syrian families who have fled their conflict and now living in Khartoum. And they are realizing that a successful revolution is not always leading to real positive change for the people. So other than being disorganized and being afraid of the government response, people are afraid that armed groups in Darfur, which are not popular in Khartoum, may try to hijack the revolution in some way. Right. We have now close to 20 different armed groups in Darfur. So the government really played on fear that if the protesters would bring down the government, they would bring down the state as well.
And the role of social media played a major part of the Arab Spring uprisings, but internet use is much lower in Sudan. Is that starting to change? Is social media starting to have an impact there?
Well, I've been monitoring social media in Sudan now on a daily basis almost for 2 years. What I can say is that the online optimism that you see on Facebook and Twitter has, to some extent, failed to translate onto the streets. One frustrated social activist who is not even in Sudan admits that, okay, she's like, this is not working. Let's try to go back to distributing flyers and printing brochures mm-hmm. instead. So there are many groups calling for change, but they are very, very disorganized. I think part of the biggest reason is that internet usage in Sudan is very limited. Not many people have access to a laptop or a computer, mm-hmm. but it is also growing very rapidly. Especially through mobile telephone technologies. People are increasingly buying smartphones and connecting through online applications where sharing videos and photographs is so easy and it's almost for free. In Sudan, although there's not a lot of limited internet usage, there's also the fact that internet usage access is very easy. Mm-hmm. You can top up your phone for 24 hours for less than one piastre, which is equal to like 20 cents. So for 24 hours, I can have internet usage on my phone. I really do believe that if social media is to play a role in Sudan and getting people onto the streets, right. it will be through mobile technology.
Yeah, I guess the government did have an inkling of this, and there was an internet blackout for a while there, right?
There was an internet blackout, not only internet, but also press media. Following protest, the National Intelligence and Security Service used a wide range of intimidation methods to ensure media cooperation, including confiscating newspapers. At one time, internet was blacked out. Journalists were being summoned. Social activists were abused and verbally threatened. Even editor-in-chiefs of newspapers were to avoid reporting about the demonstrations and the lifting of fuel subsidies. And they were ordered to use the word vandals instead of demonstrators. So that I think played a role as well. Government also said it will meet the protesters with an iron fist. At the same time, journalists that are spreading these government messages or taking sides with the government are branded by high levels of authorities as patriotic heroes. So people the journalists are going to self censorship and being very careful of what they write or what they say. We know that Sudan is ranked 170 out of 179 countries in the Reporters Without Borders Freedom Index, so that gives you a good indication.
How dangerous was it for journalists there during these protests? I know that they went on strike afterward, and you've talked about a journalist who was taking video with her telephone and was attacked. Can you describe that?
Right. Actually, that wasn't a journalist. That was a social activist. I think wasn't even a social activist. She was just an ordinary person who was mm-hmm. taking part of with the protests, and she took a picture, and I think a video of a policeman actually shooting someone and causing the death. So her online video is available on the internet very mm-hmm. easily, describing how she was beaten, how she was threatened with rape, and it was very discouraging to journalists. International news agencies were threatened. Their offices were shut down. Not only the local newspapers were subject to this, but like I said, international journalists. So it was very intimidating.
And tell us about the strike that the journalists started.
Well, the journalists went on strike. About 700 of them. They were striking against the intimidation methods. Mm-hmm. Many of them are high-level journalists or well-established journalists refused to cooperate with the National Intelligence and Security Service. Some of them go on strike for a couple of days. They go back to write, but generally, the Sudanese Journalist Network, they urged all journalists to take to the various social media outlets instead of print media to get their message across, stressing that silence is no longer possible. Many of them are saying they will not become false witnesses. They will no longer accept government restrictions over their editorial content. And yeah, the African Center for Justice and Peace said that 50 people were killed by gunshots to the chest or the head. The opposition said the death toll is higher, like you mentioned. And there's also been a very difficult, it's very difficult to get credible information. You don't know who to believe. You don't know who to trust. Even social media, it's not always people in Sudan who are reporting. Many times it's people outside of Sudan, and some of them even not Sudanese. They're uploading photographs and videos that are not necessarily taking place in Sudan. So it's been very misleading as well.
Yeah. Do you think that this has the potential to lead to the overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir?
Well, I do know that people are hesitant that is the overthrow of Omar al-Bashir the solution to Sudan's problems. Our problems are very complex. They're very multi-layered. Right now we're battling armed movements in Darfur, which we have unresolved issues with Sudan. The threat of another cessation in Sudan is very real. I do can see that the winds of change are definitely in Sudan. At times it seems slow, but it's very, very steady. But regime change in Sudan is not going to be for the people. We need to look at security and development. In terms of security, like I mentioned, the armed conflict and the tribal divisions are really taking a toll on the country. In terms of development, we have an extremely high unemployment rate. Weakening education system. I mentioned the failing economy. I think the international community must provide Sudan with political and development support. And I stress on support and not intervention, because we've seen there that doesn't work. There's also the real threat that Sudan's instability can turn the country into a safe haven for terrorists. That's a very real threat. I hesitate to use the word terrorist, because in this part of the world, you know, one person's terrorist is most likely another person's freedom fighter. Yeah. However, whatever happens in Sudan, it will be cause for an immense change throughout the African continent.
Do you think that the split in Sudan, the independence of South Sudan, is making the situation in Sudan worse or better?
It is definitely making the situation worse on so many ways. Unfortunately, after the cessation of South Sudan, the country, Sudan, failed to address political economy. We did not focus on other means to build up the economy. South Sudan took with it 75% of oil reserves. Sudan needs to focus on agriculture. We need to focus on maybe tourism. And overthrowing the government and security institutions is definitely not going to solve that. But then, what, as they say, the term with the African spring, it's going up and down, up and down. So definitely whatever happens, things will go a lot worse before they move forward and get better.
And you, Open Democracy, had an article by one of your colleagues that said the West tends to misunderstand what revolutions and rebellions in Africa are about. If there is a revolution in Sudan, it would have basically because of the economic conditions. Is that correct?
I think yes. I think the economic conditions will be the straw that breaks the camel back, like they say. If it's not the people overthrowing the government for the sake of overthrowing the government, it will be because of the economy. People will be strangled so much that they will have nothing to lose, and they will take to the streets and then wait to see what happens.
And finally, I wanted to get your gut feeling on what's happening there. You're in Riyadh now on a break, and you'll be returning to Sudan soon. When people ask you about what's happening in Sudan, do you say you're optimistic or pessimistic about the future?
I think I'm very optimistic. Change will come. Whatever change comes, it will definitely be positive change. It will not be enough for the people. Like I said, we have so many problems, very complex, very multi-layered. Everything needs to be addressed. We need to address development. We need to address security. But I do think that things will get a lot better they'll get a lot worse before they get better, but definitely will get better.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been very enlightening on what's happening in Sudan.
Thank you.
Before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You also can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter @globaljourn. The recent street protests in Sudan compelled both activists and observers to compare and contrast the demonstrations with the Arab Spring movements. Joining us now to put this issue in a wider perspective are Steve McDonald of the Woodrow Wilson Center and Rebecca Hamilton, a journalist and author of Fighting for Darfur, who teaches at Columbia Law School in New York City. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Rebecca, you've reported from inside Sudan for the Washington Post. What happened when you were in Sudan the last time, 18 months ago?
Yeah, the last time that I was in Sudan, I was actually detained by the government for reporting on the situation of Southerners who were in the north. The government officials detained me, questioned me, and since then I haven't been able to get a visa back into the country. It's part of their broader crackdown on journalists who are trying to report from inside Sudan on what's actually happening there.
Okay. And Steve, I want to have our viewers and listeners learn a little bit about you. You started as a foreign service officer in 1970, and you had quite an experience in Africa. Can you give us your thumbnail bio sketch on your experience in Africa?
A thumbnail, yeah. I first went to Africa in 1970 as a foreign service officer. In fact, the first time I visited Sudan at that time, both north and south included, was Juba in I think, 1972. So it's been a long association. But no, as a foreign service officer for about 10 years, living and working on the continent, and then a number of non-governmental, non-profit organizations that I've been working with since, all involved in democracy and governance and conflict resolution work on the continent. And I'm currently at the Woodrow Wilson Center.
Rebecca, do you think last month's unrest has the potential to lead to the overthrow of Bashir?
No one has a crystal ball. I think what we are seeing with each of these sporadic protests that have been coming up every sort of 6 months or so for the last couple of years, every time I think it's making the government more concerned and making people inside the government question the sustainability of this regime. And so it may be that we have an actual popular overthrow, which there has been some precedent for in Sudan, or it's possible that instead we see an implosion from inside the government where perhaps there's a coup. Certainly we're hearing about factions within the government that are feeling disgruntled with the current leadership. So I think that it could go either way. But there are huge hurdles for the protesters because of the brutality of the security services that the protesters meet with.
And Steve, do you agree, or do you? What do you think about?
I hate to be in a position where I just absolutely agree with the other analyst, but I absolutely agree. I think a popular protest, and they've been ongoing for some time now, has very little chance of overthrowing the Bashir regime. Very little chance. But the Bashir regime is on pretty thin ground right now. Within the government, there are very powerful forces within the intelligence and military services who are not happy with his leadership. Bashir is even blamed, believe it or not, Western perspective on this is a bit different, but blamed for the loss of the South and oil revenues and et cetera, for having been too soft in that situation. So the danger there is that an overthrow of Bashir will be from a hardline cadre within his own government, and things will be tougher, not better, for the people of Sudan.
And what are Rebecca? What are the organizing forces now?
Well, in terms of the popular protests that we've seen most recently, a core driver is the youth movement. And there's a section of those, a small section, that are very sort of internationally collected, social media savvy, and they've been trying very much, very hard to get the word out to overcome the barriers to freedom of press that they're operating within. So that's one strand is the youth movement, and that's historically been the case in Sudan, is that protests have had a core hub around the University of Khartoum and the student movements there. You also see a strand of the women's movement, which are, I think, much better at crossing the ethnic and racial lines that divide much of Sudan than perhaps other strands of protesters sometimes are. The big deficit that the movement is facing, I think, compared to earlier protest movements that you've seen in Sudan, is that when this current regime came into power, they did a good job, you know, good for their own purposes job, of dismantling the trade unions and the organized professional classes that had been so key in mobilizing these popular movements in the past.
Before I go on to you, Steve, I wanted to go back to one thing you said, Rebecca, about the women's movement. I was intrigued. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Just that Sudanese women have been impressively organized over recent years at trying to connect with each other across different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only when speaking to people who identify themselves as first and foremost women and part of a women's movement, that in doing interviews, I've heard people who are women who are in Darfur speak with such compassion about women who were in the south before it separated, or women in Khartoum talking about women who are in the Nuba Mountains. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of connectivity to other areas of Sudan that I don't always see with other people who are part of a protest movement in Sudan.
Okay, that's interesting. Steve, I wanted to ask you, did the split of Sudan, independent, successful independence movement for South Sudan, how does that affect people who wanted for years to change the regime in Sudan? Does that make it harder or easier?
It's a difficult question because of perspective. I mean, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement that was signed in 2005. That led to the referendum that led to the independence of South Sudan, actually had a codicil in it that almost everybody has forgotten about now, which was that both North and South Sudan were to make unity as attractive an option as possible for the people of South Sudan so that they had an option, that they could choose to remain united with the North as one state, or they could choose their independence. Well, both North and South did not try to fulfill that part of the agreement for their differing reasons. And a lot of people who are deeply steeped in the history and the personalities of Sudan think of John Garang, the leader of South Sudan, would have stayed alive, that he might have made a difference there, and we might have had a very different situation now. So the issues that needed to be ironed out, which were part of the CPA agreement, those are the border dispute issues, the border commission that was supposed to be set up to solve a bay and Blue Nile and South Kordofan and the oil revenue issues, sharing of oil revenues, and et cetera. None of that was dealt with. Mm-hmm. We just moved pell-mell headlong into the referendum and independence and from the South. And so both North and South are suddenly left with the situation where they're divided, where they're separate states, where none of the issues that had divided them in the past have been addressed. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the legacy that bedevils us today in terms of North-South relations and some of the internal problems of both countries. Now, of course, North Sudan has been and still remains an autocratic state. There are great human rights issues in Darfur and in some of the other border areas that are ongoing. But it all stems from a lack of coming to grips with any of those issues that were supposed to have been a part of the original Comprehensive Peace Agreement.
Rebecca, do you think the efforts for reform in the North have been how has it been affected by the split?
I mean, first I would say I completely agree with Steve about the unity provisions of the CPA having been brushed aside a long time ago. But I think that we've seen a big spike in popular unrest since the secession of the South for two reasons. Firstly, I think for a long time, this regime had been using the South as a way to build itself up. It could cast the South as the sort of common enemy, and any problems that it was experiencing, it could blame on what was happening in the South. Mm-hmm. And that sort of excuse or that scapegoat has become much more difficult now the South is an independent country. But secondly, and probably most importantly, has been the economic impact of the South secession, because, you know, the bulk of Sudan's oil lay in the South, and so that's now belonging to South Sudan. And, of course, there have been problems working out how to pass out oil revenue and oil sharing. So the hits to the northern economy have been enormous, and that has really catalyzed these popular protests, because previously you had had a lot of people in Sudan who had been unhappy with the government for a range of reasons related to poor governance and human rights violations. But it's only when you have this economic decline that it tends to affect your every person. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter which ethnicity or race you're from or which part of the country you're in. If the fuel subsidy is lifted, then you're going to take a hit. And so suddenly the range of people who would mm-hmm. consider actually turning out to a protest has increased mm-hmm. since the secession of the South.
Rebecca, most,
if I may, I absolutely agree. I think that the trigger of the current protests in the North has been this economic situation, huge inflation, dropping of oil subsidies. Things have really gotten bad. They were somewhat insulated in the past. But I'd also caution that as we talk about Sudan, that is North Sudan, and its internal problems of governance and what's going to happen there, that we may be facing similar situations in the South, where we have a lack of good governance, we have a growing sense of autocracy building.
Rebecca, do you want to comment on that? On the South?
No. I mean, I think the North should serve as a very strong warning mm-hmm. for the South's new leadership, and it surely aspires for something better than what it sees on its northern border.
Okay. Rebecca, I know comparisons are always difficult. Every country has its own dynamics. But what do you think of the Arab Spring countries? What is the closest corollary to what's happening in Sudan? Would it be Tunisia, maybe?
I mean, the comparisons are difficult. I think, you know, as we were talking about, the economic catalysts are certainly there in comparison to the Tunisian example. And it's funny, a number of Sudanese friends, when the sort of Arab Spring started happening, were like, well, you know, finally the rest of the Arab world is catching up to what we started back in 64. So there is this sort of popular mythology, mm-hmm. you know, grounded in fact, in the Sudanese mind about the capacity of Sudanese to overthrow regimes that are illegitimate, but we don't have the great circumstances there for them to do it right now.
We've run out of time. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for helping us put this in perspective.
No problem.
Okay.
Enjoyed it.
Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today was freelance journalist Salma Ismail, Steve McDonald of the Woodrow Wilson Center, and Rebecca Hamilton, author of the book Fighting for Darfur. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Zara Rasool was the lead producer. Please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.